Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
First of all, we now got all the text messages between him and his roommate, romantic partner, what they were saying back and forth after the assassination. Plus, you guys remember, we thought that it was his dad who first turned him in, who spotted him in the surveillance photo. It actually wasn't him. And I'll explain all this coming up in this episode of the True Crime Never Sleeps special of the murder of Charlie Kirk. All right, I want to give you the latest on the Tyler Robinson investigation. He, of course, is the man accused of assassinating Charlie Kirk. And we got a ton of new information today from authorities, all sorts of details about the investigation. I'm going to go through it all with you. But let me get you the new information. First of all, the charges are aggravated murder, 2 obstruction of justice charges, 1 for moving and concealing the rifle, the other for disposing of clothing he wore. Witness tampering for directing his roommate to delete text, which I'm going to get to in a second. Another charge of witness tampering for directing his roommate to stay silent if police questioned him. Commission of a violent offense in the presence of a child because there were kids at the Charlie Kirk event. And then the county attorney also gave notice of intent to seek the death penalty. And just this week, we found out that there was DNA found on the rifle's trigger. They say he hid his gun, which I knew about. Remember, previous video, I showed you that wooded area across the street from the campus where he left the gun. He discarded his clothing and told his roommate again to delete text messages and not talk to police. And they confirmed, which we all knew because we had the video, that when he shot, allegedly, Charlie Kirk, Charlie was answering a question about transgender individuals. He walked with the rifle hidden in his pants, which was sort of the theory I had. You remember that video from the Ring camera on the street where it looked like he had that really weird limp, but then in another video he was running? The prosecutor said it's because he had the rifle hidden in his pants. That's why he was walking with the limp. Prosecutor confirmed that this week. And then he ended up going to the Washington County Sheriff's Office with family and a family friend to turn himself in. So that part we actually knew. So Robinson's mother said that on September 11th, the day after the shooting, she saw the photo of the shooter on the news, and she thought that it looked like her son. So it was the mom who actually first thought that. She called her son, asked her where he was, and he said that he had been home sick. He said he was sick on September 10th, the day of the shooting. Even after hearing that from her son, she still expressed concern to her husband that the photo that had been released looked like her son, Tyler. She told police that he had become more political, started to lean towards the left, became more pro-gay and trans-right oriented, and then he had started dating his roommate, who was a biological male, who was transitioning. This apparently resulted in conversations with his father. This is all before the shooting, and they were kind of jumping around a bit. He said that UVU, which is where the shooting was a stupid venue for the event, and that Kirk spread hate. So the rifle, also interestingly, that he used matched a rifle that the dad had given to him as a gift. Robinson's father contacted his son Tyler and asked him to send a photo of the rifle. So basically, after the mom was concerned, like, you know, this looks like your son, the dad gets involved, texts the son and says, send me a picture of the rifle to basically prove that, you know, he had the rifle and that this wasn't him. And Tyler, surprisingly, did not respond. Then they got on the phone after texting and on the police, according to prosecutors. Tyler said he was going to take his own life. The dad convinced him to come to his parents' house and have a meeting at the house. And that's when, according to prosecutors, He said that he was the shooter and that he didn't want to go to jail and just wanted to end it. That's the way prosecutors described it. When asked why he did it, he said, "There's too much evil and the guy spreads too much hate." A family convinced Robinson, his parents, to speak with a family friend who's a retired sheriff. And then the parents and the family friend, this part we had reported, basically convinced Robinson to turn himself in to police. And that's when they went to the Washington County Sheriff's Office. Police interviewed Robinson's roommate, a biological male, who was involved in a romantic relationship with Robinson. So the roommate, remember, we first heard roommate, but now we know they were, like the governor described it, as romantic partners. The roommate told police he received text messages from Robinson about the shooting.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
But the county attorney describing the text messages back and forth said, quote,
"The roommate. Police interviewed Robinson's roommate, a biological male who was involved in a romantic relationship with Robinson. The roommate told police that the roommate received messages from Robinson about the shooting, and he did provide those messages to police. On September 10th, 2025, the roommate received a text message from Robinson, which said, 'Drop what you're doing. Look under my keyboard.' The roommate looked under the keyboard and found a note that stated, quote, 'I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I'm going to take it.' Police found a photograph of this note. The following text exchange then took place. After reading the note, the roommate responded, 'What? You're joking, right? Robinson, I am still okay, my love, but am stuck in Orem for a little while longer yet. Shouldn't be long until I can come home, but I gotta grab my rifle still. To be honest, I had hoped to keep this secret till I died of old age. I am sorry to involve you. Roommate, you weren't the one who did it, right? Robinson, I am, I'm sorry. Roommate, I thought they caught the person. Robinson, no, they grabbed some crazy old dude, then interrogated someone in similar clothing. I had planned to grab my rifle from my drop point shortly after, but most of that side of town got locked down. It's quiet, almost enough to get out, but there's one vehicle lingering. Roommate, why? Robinson, why did I do it? Roommate, yeah. Robinson, I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out. If I am able to grab my rifle unseen, I will have left no evidence. Going to attempt to retrieve it again. Hopefully they have moved on. I haven't seen anything about them finding it. Roommate, How long have you been planning this? Robinson, a bit over a week, I believe. I can get close to it, but there is a squad car parked right by it. I think they already swept that spot, but I don't want to chance it. Robinson again, I'm wishing I had circled back and grabbed it as soon as I got to my vehicle. I'm worried what my old man would do if I didn't bring back Grandpa's rifle. IDEK, if it's had a serial number, but it wouldn't trace to me. I worry about prints. I had to leave it in a bush where I changed outfits. Didn't have the ability or time to bring it with. I might have to abandon it and hope they don't find prints. How the F will I explain losing it to my old man? Only thing I left was the rifle wrapped in a towel. Remember how I was engraving bullets? The effing messages are mostly a big meme. If I see notice bulge UWU on Fox News, I might have a stroke, all right. I'm going to have to leave it. That really effing sucks. Judging from today, I'd say Grandpa's gun does just fine, IDK. I think that was a $2K dollar scope. Wink, wink. Robinson again, delete this exchange. Again, Robinson, my dad wants photos of the rifle. He says Grandpa wants to know who has what. The feds released a photo of the rifle, and it is very unique. He's calling me, RN, not answering. Robinson, since Trump got into office, my dad has been pretty diehard MAGA. Robinson, I'm going to turn myself in willingly. One of my neighbors here is a deputy for the sheriff. Again, you are all I worry about, love. That came from Robinson. Roommate, I'm much more worried about you. Robinson, don't talk to the media, please. Don't take any interviews or make any comments. If any police ask you questions, ask for a lawyer and stay silent.
We thank you for watching, and remember, stay updated on breaking news and top stories on the NBC News app or watch live on our YouTube channel.
Police interviewed Robinson's roommate, a biological male who was involved in a romantic relationship with Robinson. The roommate told police that he received messages from Robinson about the shooting, and he provided those messages to police. On September 10th, the roommate received a text from Robinson that said, "Drop what you're doing, look under the keyboard." The roommate looked under the keyboard and found a note that stated, quote, "I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I'm going to take it." Police found a photograph of this note. Following text then took place. Roommate, "What? You're joking, right?" Robinson, "I'm still okay, my love, but I'm stuck in Orem for a little while longer. Shouldn't be long until I can come home, but I gotta grab my rifle still. To be honest, I had hoped to keep this secret till I died of old age. I'm sorry to involve you. You weren't the one who did it, right?" I am. I'm sorry, roommate. I thought they caught the person. No, they grabbed some crazy old dude, then interrogated someone in similar clothing. I had planned to grab my rifle from the drop point shortly after. Most of that side of town got locked down. It's quiet, almost enough to get out, but there's one vehicle lingering. Why? Why did I do it? Yes. I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out. If I am able to grab my rifle unseen, I will have left no evidence. Going to attempt to retrieve it again. Hopefully they have moved on. I haven't seen anything about them finding it. How long have you been planning this? A bit over a week, I believe. I can get close to it. There's a squad car parked right by it. I think they already swept that spot, but I don't want to chance it. I'm wishing I had circled back and grabbed it as soon as I got to my vehicle. I'm worried what my old man would do if I didn't bring back my grandpa's rifle. I don't know if it's had a serial number, but it wouldn't trace to me. I'm worried about prints. Leave it in a bush where I changed outfits. Didn't have the ability or time to bring it with. I might have to abandon it and hope they don't find prints. How the fuck will I explain losing it to my old man? Only thing I left was the rifle wrapped in a towel. Remember how I was engraving bullets? The fucking messages are mostly a big meme. If I see notice bulge UWU on Fox News, judging from today, I'd say Grandpa's gun does just fine. I don't know. I think that was a $2,000 scope. Delete this exchange again. My dad wants photos of the rifle. He says grandpa wants to know who has what. Feds released a photo of the rifle, and it is very unique. He's calling me right now, unanswering. Since Trump got into office, my dad has been pretty diehard MAGA. I'm going to turn myself in willingly. One of my neighbors here is a deputy for the sheriff. Again, you are all I worry about, love. I'm much more worried about you. Don't talk to the media. Please don't take any interviews or make any comments. If any police ask you questions, ask for a lawyer, and stay silent. So something else interesting, the county attorney was asked about other suspects. Could anyone else be involved? Because there's been all sorts of questions about Discord and this whole group chat. Did other people know about it? And the county attorney said, quote, no information right now about other suspects, but investigators could continue to follow leads. He sort of emphasized that investigators will follow leads. So that was the latest from the prosecutor this week and the latest on the investigation. There also has been some interesting reporting from the Washington Post that says the 22-year-old suspect in Charlie Kirk's killing appears to have confessed to friends in an online chat shortly before turning himself in to law enforcement, according to people familiar with the chat and screenshots. Now, the prosecutor didn't bring this up, only talked about the text messages with the roommate. But the Washington Post is saying he also confessed to friends and said, quote, hey guys, I have bad news for you all. It was me at UVU yesterday. I'm sorry for all of this. Apparently, he sent those messages out on Thursday night, about 2 hours before officials said he was taken into custody. Some of those people turned over those screenshots to the Washington Post. There were some other messages, too. And then, something else new today that I found really interesting. You guys remember right after Charlie Kirk was shot, the first person brought into custody was that older man? Remember there were all those videos? I saw a bunch on TikTok. Everyone thought they had the shooter in custody right away. You can see videos of them taking this older guy away in handcuffs. It turns out that was not the shooter. But now we're getting more information about who that person was, and it's kind of bizarre. The Utah County Sheriff's Office put out a release about arresting and booking him. His name is George Zinn, and he's been arrested for obstruction of justice and possession of child sex abuse material. They said that at Utah Valley University on September 10th, which is the day of the shooting, Zinn was attending the event where the shooting occurred. Shortly after the shooting, and while people were fleeing the area, Zinn was seen yelling that he had shot Charlie Kirk. So he was literally yelling that he shot Charlie Kirk. Campus police took Zinn into custody and transported him to the police department. At that time, Zinn was not cooperative with law enforcement and didn't want to speak with investigators. Then Zinn began to have a medical issue and was transported to a local hospital. And while at the hospital, he did freely state that he was not the shooter, but that he yelled that he was to hinder the law enforcement response. So he was trying to hinder the police response, apparently. While Zinn was at the hospital, an FBI agent and an agent from the Utah State Bureau of Investigations met with him. Zinn agreed to speak with them concerning the matter, and during the interview, he admitted that he yelled that he was the shooter to allow the actual suspect to flee and to hinder law enforcement. During the interview, the agents asked to look at Zinn's phone, and he agreed. He told agents that he used his phone to view and abuse child sex abuse material, and there might be some images on it. The agents did see several images on the phone of prepubescent girls scantily dressed. At that time, Utah County Special Victims Unit detectives were asked to take over the matter as the other agents were needed to help with the shooting. So that took a strange turn. He's now being charged with felony obstruction of justice and felony sexual exploitation of a minor. At this time, there's no information that George Zinn actually colluded with the shooter, but it certainly caused a lot of confusion. You remember that video? First, he was taken into custody. People thought he was the shooter. Then there was another person they were interviewing, and that's when the FBI director initially put out a tweet saying they had a subject in custody. That turned out to be wrong. So this only added to all that confusion. I've been following this case closely, and the more I've read through these text messages between Tyler and his romantic partner, the more disturbing the full picture becomes. There's just so much there in terms of mindset, motive, and behavior. The texts are chilling, but what stands out most is how calculated and emotionless they come across. There's this very casual tone, like what he did was just another thing in his day. I mean, the way he was texting after the assassination, talking about retrieving the rifle, apologizing for involving his partner, it almost felt like he was talking about forgetting to take the trash out. He showed no remorse. That right there is what struck me as classic narcissism. This wasn't a person in crisis or someone who snapped out of nowhere. He was calculated, methodical, self-absorbed. The way he downplayed everything, even while admitting guilt, it showed that he placed his own emotional discomfort above the consequences of what he'd done. And that narcissism, it ran deep. He talked about how he couldn't stand Charlie Kirk, said that Kirk spread hate and evil and that some hate can't be negotiated out. So in his mind, that made it okay. He believed he was the one to stop it, like he was the person to bring justice. But what kind of justice is that? He couldn't beat Charlie in a debate. He couldn't disprove his ideology or publicly dismantle his views. So what does he do instead? He kills him. He decides to take him out. That's not just narcissism. It's obsession. He even said in one of his texts, "I had hoped to keep this secret till I died of old age." That line stuck with me. It shows that this was planned, thought out, not a spur-of-the-moment decision. He had been preparing. He had mapped out his drop point for the weapon. He walked awkwardly with it stuffed down his pants. He had an escape plan. He had already told his partner where to find a note, what to say, what not to say. And he engraved messages on the bullets. That's not spontaneous rage. That's ideology. That's someone who wants to leave a message, whether or not he's around to read it. And yet, in his messages, he still seemed most anxious about how his father would react to the rifle going missing. That disconnect is terrifying. He just assassinated someone, and his concern is how to explain to his dad that he lost Grandpa's gun. That's the real crisis. It shows you how totally unmoored from reality he was. That level of detachment doesn't just happen. It builds over time. It builds in online echo chambers. It builds when people stop engaging with real-world consequences and instead marinate in their own belief systems and resentments. There are red flags everywhere in this case, from his increasing radicalization and political shifts to the people in his life noting changes in behavior. There was leakage, that's the term for it. People like this don't just bottle it up until they explode. They drop hints, they make comments, they post memes, they write manifestos or text cryptic things to people around them. And too often, those signs are brushed off until it's too late. Looking at this case, it's clear he had grievances, deep ones. He became isolated, bitter, angry. He developed a fantasy of violence and revenge and nurtured it in secret. That's how it happens. And I have to say what's almost more disturbing is the casual, matter-of-fact tone of those texts. The way he told his partner, don't talk to the media, don't answer questions, ask for a lawyer. Like this was just standard procedure, like it was all part of the plan. That, more than anything, shows just how far gone he was. One thing I kept coming back to was the role of the roommate or romantic partner, as the governor described him. The police and the governor have gone out of their way to say this person is cooperating, extremely cooperative. That stood out to me. But I kept asking myself, did this person really not know anything? I mean, just look at those texts again. Tyler sent him a message saying, drop what you're doing, look under the keyboard. The partner finds a little note saying he's going to assassinate Charlie Kirk. And then, still, the guy seems unsure and replies, you're joking, right? Like, really? That response doesn't feel like total shock. It feels like maybe there had already been talk. Maybe not a full-blown plan, but something. In the way Robinson was texting, he clearly wasn't worried the partner would panic and go to the police. He trusted him. Enough to admit what he'd done, to ask for help, hiding it, and to say, please delete this. So no, I don't believe the partner knew nothing. I find it highly unlikely. If I had to guess, I'd say there were probably prior conversations, maybe about Kirk's politics, maybe even some darker hypotheticals. Maybe those didn't seem real at the time, but hindsight has a way of changing everything. And when Robinson texted that final string of confessions, I think the partner realized it was all true. Still, the police say this person is cooperating fully, and maybe that's true. But I'd honestly be surprised if he isn't eventually charged in some way. Even if it's not a direct conspiracy charge, if you look at the scale of this case, the media attention, the political pressure, I think anyone even close to this is going to get caught in the fallout. That leads into something else, leakage. There's a concept in behavioral threat assessment before people carry out violent acts, they often show pre-offense behavior. They don't just act in a vacuum, they drop signs, they obsess, they spiral, they leak. There's a stat I've seen cited from studies done on mass shooters. In 81% of the cases, at least one other person knew something beforehand. In 60% of the cases, two or more people knew. That tells you something right there. Whether it was the roommate, friends, or even family, someone probably heard Tyler say something alarming. Maybe it didn't sound serious at the time. Maybe it was a rant, or a joke, or just an edgy meme. But it meant something. Even his dad got suspicious when he wouldn't respond about the rifle. His mom said she thought the suspect in the photo looked like him. And what about that dinner the week before the shooting, where family members reportedly talked about Kirk? It paints a picture. He wasn't hiding all this, at least not perfectly. That's the thing. People often do say something, but the people around them either don't believe them, don't know what to do, or think it's just talk. So the signs get ignored till it's too late. And that's what happened here. When I look at everything, especially the texts, the notes, the behavior, what stands out the most to me is how deeply obsessed Tyler was with Charlie Kirk. This wasn't a random act. It wasn't spur of the moment. It was focused, specific, directed. I mean, he literally said to his partner in one of the texts, "I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out." That tells you exactly where his mind was. He had assigned a moral justification to what he did. He believed this was an act of ideological warfare, that he was doing the world a favor. That level of obsession mixed with narcissism creates a dangerous combination. He couldn't win a debate. He couldn't make a counter-argument stick. So instead, he chose to eliminate the person altogether. That's what it came down to. And the detail that really got me, he engraved messages on the bullets. When I first heard that, I assume it was meant as a message for whoever found the weapon, like some kind of sick calling card. But after reading the text, I think he never intended anyone to find the bullets. He didn't plan to be caught. He wanted to disappear with the secret intact. He even said he was sorry to involve his partner and hoped to keep it a secret until he died of old age. That shows you how much fantasy was driving this. He had planned it all out in his head. Political justification, the practical logistics, the cleanup, the silence, the martyrdom. And yet, even while building this fantasy, he was still totally disconnected from reality. He thought no one would notice, that the surveillance video wouldn't catch him, that his own mother wouldn't recognize him. That's what I keep circling back to, this complete lack of real-world grounding. He's more worried about how to explain a missing rifle to his father than about the fact that he just killed somebody on camera. He's still texting "my love" to his partner, like he's just running errands and will be home soon. It's not just detached, it's delusional. And that delusion, it's being fed somewhere. These people don't exist in a vacuum. They're online, they're consuming content, they're sharing memes. They're in echo chambers where everything they believe is reinforced and radicalized. There was a quote I saw floating around online, something like, "After all this, I can't even distinguish what's real and what's not anymore." It might have been a post from someone in the same Discord group as him, or a Reddit comment. It doesn't really matter where it came from, because it sums up exactly what we're seeing. A generation of people so caught up in their own isolated digital worlds that reality starts to bend. And when it bends far enough, someone decides they're the hero of their own story, and they act. As I sat with all of this, I kept asking myself the bigger question. Why are we seeing more of this? Why does it feel like these kind of attacks, these ideologically driven acts of violence, are becoming more common, especially among young white men? It's a hard thing to talk about, but it keeps coming up in these cases. The level of partisan mistrust in this country is high, historically high. It's not just in politics, it's in everything. People are retreating into online echo chambers where they rarely engage with opposing views. And when they do, it's not respectful. It's not constructive. It's hostile. We've created this digital world where cultural war issues, race, gender, guns, religion, education, all get weaponized. They become identity markers, battle lines. And guys like Tyler Robinson, they internalize that. They go from being politically opinionated to being ideologically radicalized. And what makes it worse is that in these online spaces, extreme views aren't just tolerated, they're celebrated. They're made to feel normal. Like it's not only okay to hate someone like Kirk, but it's heroic to act on it. There's no filter, no pause, no reflection. And part of that, I think, comes from the fact that mainstream figures, people in media, even some politicians, have helped normalize this language. Sometimes explicitly, sometimes with a wink and a nod, but the message still gets through. I remember reading something from a recent failed vice presidential candidate who posted something like, "Oh, I woke up today and Trump is still alive. Huh, how about that?" We don't even realize how corrosive that is, but people like Robinson, they hear that, they read that, they internalize it. They see it as permission, as validation. They don't have the maturity or the mental stability to process that critically, especially not when their entire lives are consumed by screens, memes, Reddit threads, Discord servers, message boards, YouTube rabbit holes. There's no grounding in real-world values anymore. No connection to consequences. It's just performance and escalation. And maybe, just maybe, if they could see what happens on the other side, they might reconsider. I've thought about that. Like, what if one of these young men who's now in prison for life sat down for a recorded interview, someone who's 10 years removed from their crime, who has zero chance of ever getting out, just to show other young people, this is what your life becomes. You're 28 years old and you're done. No future, no respect, no cause left to fight for. Would it stop the next person? I don't know. Probably not the true believers, but maybe the one on the edge, the one teetering, the one four levels down in the extremist pipeline, who still has a foot in the real world. And there's something I keep coming back to, those engraved bullets. When I first started reporting on this, I thought maybe Tyler was leaving a message for whoever might find them, like some kind of statement. But now, after reading the full text conversation, I'm not so sure. He texted his partner about it like it was a joke. He said the messages on the bullets were mostly a big meme. And yet, he still went through the effort to engrave them. That's not a joke. That's someone acting out a fantasy. A fantasy that probably only made sense in his head, or in the niche online spaces where this kind of thing is normalized. And here's what really gets me. I don't even think he intended for anyone to find those bullets. I don't think he wanted the gun found. He didn't plan on getting caught. He said that the whole thing was supposed to stay secret. He even told his partner, "I had hoped to keep this secret until I died of old age." But the fact that he engraved those bullets anyways, that he couldn't resist leaving some kind of hidden message, says a lot about his psychology. This wasn't just about killing someone. It was about crafting a narrative. He was living in this internal story where he was the anti-hero, the righteous avenger, the misunderstood soldier fighting evil. And that's exactly how these acts of violence take root. It doesn't start with a plan, it starts with a grievance. In this case, his grievance was Charlie Kirk's rhetoric. The things Charlie said about gender, politics, culture, Tyler didn't agree. And that disagreement turned in resentment, then hatred, then fantasy. Over time, it snowballed. It became more isolated, more radicalized, more emotionally invested in this internal story where he could fix the world by silencing the person he saw as the source of evil. That fantasy, it gets fed by online communities. It gets validated by memes, videos, posts, chats, even influencers. And when it's strong enough, the fantasy starts to replace reality. Suddenly, planning a murder doesn't seem insane. It seems justified, even seems noble. That's how far gone he was. And when the time came, he didn't act with hesitation. He moved with focus, preparation, scoped out the location, concealed the rifle, chose his moment, and walked away like nothing happened. He didn't think he'd be caught. But once he realized the net was closing in, it shifted. The fantasy collapsed. He started texting his partner in a panic, asking him to delete messages, stay silent, not talk to the media, not cooperate. He was trying to salvage whatever was left of the illusion. That's the part where the real world finally caught up. But by then, it was too late. As I kept thinking about everything Tyler Robinson said and did, the texts, the planning, the messages on the bullets, I started remembering the concept I once came across. It's called identification. A group of behavioral experts, Malloy, Molin, Malloy, and Hoffman, developed it years ago to describe how violent actors begin to see themselves, not just as individuals, but as part of a larger symbolic mission. And when I went back through their model, Tyler fit it almost perfectly. There's this idea of becoming a pseudo-commando. It means someone starts assuming the posture, appearance, and behavior of a soldier. They see themselves as engaged in a kind of war. They talk about revenge. They believe they're restoring justice or obliterating evil. That was Tyler. He literally said there's too much evil and the guy spreads too much hate. Then there's the warrior mentality. That sense that you're in combat, that you're fighting a larger abstract enemy, not just a person, but an ideology, a movement, a system. In his case, it was Charlie Kirk's public platform, his speech, his beliefs. Tyler saw that as a direct threat, not just to him, but to the people he claimed to be defending. Now there's a secret or obsessive connection to weapons and military symbolism. Again, engraved bullets, high-end scope, hidden rifle, the messages. This wasn't about self-defense. It was about identity, about feeling powerful, feeling capable, feeling like a soldier, even though he had no military background. Then there's the element of wanting to outdo or emulate other assassins or attackers. We've seen this pattern before, people referencing previous shooters, writing manifestos, and filming themselves, leaving notes. Even if Tyler didn't explicitly cite others, he followed the playbook, and in his messages, there was this strange sense of performance, like he was aware of how it might all look after the fact. And finally, and maybe most importantly, there's the belief that you're acting on behalf of a cause, and that you're just not, that you're not just angry, not just broken, but that you're a soldier, that you're necessary, that the mission you're on justifies the violence. That's what Tyler believed. It's written all over his words. So when I go back and read those texts, when I hear him say, I had enough of his hatred, and some hate can't be negotiated out, I just don't hear rage. I hear belief. Twisted belief, yes, but belief nonetheless. And here's the terrifying part. He didn't think he was wrong. In fact, I think he believed, deep down, that other people would agree with him. That they'd look at what he did and say, well, someone had to stop Kirk. He thought he'd be a hero in certain circles. Sadly, based on what I've seen online, he's not entirely wrong. There are people out there who are treating this like a victory, celebrating it, rationalizing it. That's the world we're in now, where someone like Tyler can start as a college student with political opinions and end up seeing himself as a righteous killer, a symbol, a weapon. And once that identity takes hold, once someone fully adopts that soldier of justice, they're almost impossible to pull back. At some point, I had to ask the bigger question. Why does this keep happening? Why is it that we're seeing the same profile over and over again? Young white men, radicalized, isolated, angry, and eventually violent. The answer isn't simple, but there are patterns, and those patterns are getting harder to ignore. A lot of it comes down to partisan mistrust. People are so locked into their belief systems, so emotionally invested in political identity, that they can't tolerate opposing views, not just disagree with them. They feel threatened by them, and when you combine that with online culture, it becomes a pressure cooker. Online people find communities that tell them they're right, and not just right, but righteous, that their anger is justified, that violence is under the right circumstances, heroic. And when you spend enough time in that world, the real world starts to look fake. The delusion becomes your new reality. And it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. It's happening on the far right, it's happening on the far left, and it's happening anywhere, right? Ideology becomes identity, where disagreement is treated like war. In Tyler Robinson's case, the rhetoric that surrounded him wasn't coming from some fringe site hidden in the dark web. A lot of it was mainstream, sanitized, packaged into memes, delivered in podcasts, and TikToks, and Discord messages. It's not always overt, but it's corrosive. I remember one example someone brought up, a public figure joking online after an assassination attempt saying, oh, Trump's still alive? How about that? People laughed, but that kind of sarcasm, that kind of gleeful dehumanization, gets logged in the minds of people like Tyler. It reinforces a fantasy that some people deserve what's coming to them. And if you're somebody already spiraling, already hurt, angry, confused, those little signals act like green lights. I keep thinking, what's happening to these young men? Because that's who we keep seeing. And they're not just angry, they're directionless. They don't feel purpose. They don't feel useful. And when they don't have strong families or communities or mentors guiding them, they go looking for meaning elsewhere. And right now, the internet is waiting to give it to them. It gives them structure, identity, belonging. It tells them why they feel the way they do, and more dangerously, gives them someone to blame. and once they find their villain, the idea of using violence stops being unthinkable. It becomes inevitable. So much of this makes me wonder, could it have been stopped? Were there signs that people missed, or worse, saw and ignored? Because when you look back, there were signs everywhere. The text between Tyler and his partner, the rants about Charlie Kirk, the comment about having the chance to take him out, the engraved bullets, the political radicalization, the emotional detachment. It was all leakage, behavioral leakage. The term leakage comes up in almost every one of these cases. It refers to how people planning acts of violence often signal their intent, even if they don't say it directly. They'll joke about it, hint at it, text boundaries, send up little red flags to see how people react. And when no one reacts, or worse, when they're validated, they take it as a permission to go further. In fact, like I mentioned, there's a statistic that I've thought about a lot lately. In 81% of mass shootings, at least one other person knew something beforehand. 60%, two or more people knew. That's staggering. And yet in this case, we're being told the partner is fully cooperating. Law enforcement says they're being helpful. Maybe that's true. But I can't stop asking myself, did they really not know anything? Did they really not suspect anything? Because in the text, the roommate asked, how long have you been planning this? And Tyler said, a bit over a week. But that's not how these things work. People don't go from a casual disagreement with a public figure to assassination in 7 days. There's a pathway to violence, a trajectory. It starts with a grievance. And in this case, we know what that was, Charlie Kirk's politics. Tyler didn't agree. He took it personally. Then comes the ideation, where the idea of violence starts to feel like a solution. After that, the person begins to plan. Then they prepare. They scout the scene, acquire the weapon, start rehearsing. And somewhere in that sequence, there's almost always leakage to a friend, a partner, a family member. In Tyler's case, we know his mother recognized him in the surveillance photo. She confronted him. He lied, said he was homesick. She told his dad. His dad texted him, asking for a picture of the rifle. Tyler didn't respond. Eventually, he called and said he was going to take his own life. That's when the family finally got involved and helped him turn himself in. But think about that, how close it all came to being ignored completely. If his mother had doubted her gut, if his dad hadn't followed up, no one pushed, he might never have been caught. And if we're being honest, he probably wouldn't have turned himself in if his family hadn't stepped in. Not because of guilt, but because of his fantasy was falling apart. The lockdown, the vehicle lingering by the drop point, the texts, the surveillance. He knew the clock was ticking. So now I ask, can we catch these things earlier? Is there a world where someone like Tyler Robinson gets flagged before the violence happens? Where someone reports him? Where a parent takes a threat seriously, even if it's vague? Where a friend doesn't shrug off a weird comment as just venting? I don't know, but I do know this. If we don't start taking those moments seriously, if we keep brushing them off, we're going to keep ending up right here. As I come to the end of this, the question I'm left with is what now? What can we actually do realistically in a society that seems to keep producing people like Tyler Robinson? I don't have all the answers, but I know this. We can't keep pretending it's just random. These aren't isolated explosions of madness. These are the end result of grievances, radicalization, ideology, and neglect, all working together over time. And when we treat these acts like lightning strikes, we absolve ourselves of doing anything about them. So let's be honest. We have a mental health crisis. We have a violence problem. We have a digital radicalization pipeline that's operating 24/7. And we have entire online subcultures telling young men that violence isn't just acceptable, it's righteous. That has to change. And yes, free speech matters. Yes, we live in a country where people are allowed to have opposing political views, but that's not what this is about. This is about people who can't handle opposition, people who turn disagreement into dehumanization, and then dehumanization into violence. That's the pattern. So what do? We have to start earlier. We have to educate parents, teachers, coaches, mentors about what leakage looks like. We have to create pathways for intervention that aren't just about arrest, but about recognition, about saying, this kid is spiraling, he's angry, he's posting threats, something's wrong. We need better support systems for people on the edge, not just after they explode, but while they're building up the pressure. And yes, we need to hold people accountable. That includes the shooters, of course, but might also include people who knew something and stayed silent, because silent at a certain point becomes complicity. We also need to stop glorifying these killers, stop repeating their names, stop turning them into infamous figures. They don't deserve that legacy. The only name we should remember is the one they tried to silence, Charlie Kirk. And finally, we have to look at ourselves. What kind of country are we building where political disagreement feels like a death sentence? When a college student can convince himself that the only way to make the world better is to murder a public speaker. If that's where we are, if that's what we're creating, we're all part of the problem. So let's stop pretending we're powerless. Let's start paying attention. Let's say something before the next one happens. Because if this case has shown us anything, it's that the signs were there. We just have to be willing to look. And that is all we have for this episode. Give us a thumbs up if you like our video. Hit that subscribe button down below. Hit the bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.